He walked aft, took the tiller from Shatrow, swung the launch around again, and propelled us at full speed down the river, directly toward the fight. Shatrow scrambled to the middle of the launch. "Where are we going?" he shouted. "That boat is going to founder," Randall said. Shatrow sat beside Larissa, who stared straight ahead like a doll, frightened out of her wits. The cries from inside the listing flatboat came louder now. A few bullets zizzed past our heads, until voices on the banks shouted that we were not Bryanists. The river was backing up behind the flatboats 15 meters ahead, and we began to yaw in an eddy. Randall took advantage of the eddy and steered us to the right. The rightmost flatboat, heeling onto its starboard side, suddenly threw open its cabin hatches and seemed to erupt. Heads, arms, legs poured onto the deck. Children, I saw. Over 2 dozen of them. I could not help crying out, and Randall nodded grimly, tears on his cheeks falling in twin glittering streams. The children leaped and fell off the tilting deck into the water. A man carrying 2 babies lost his balance and also fell. For a moment he held the babies up, then let them go, and swam to save himself. I thought of ants falling from a floating leaf. The water was filled with bobbing heads. A few Bryanist soldiers, but mostly children of all ages. Our boat moved in among them, and Shatrow and I immediately began grabbing arms, legs, heads, pulling children into the boat, 5, 6, 8, 9, I lost count. Larissa remained rooted to her seat, staring left and right like an antique toy. A young girl with slick wet hair climbed over her, crying out, "I know you! I know you!" and tried to hug her. Larissa pushed her away with frightened disgust. More boats came from the shore now. Dinghies and smacks and canoes. The river filled with boats. A crouching soldier on the flatboat mechanically aimed and shot his rifle into the rescuers. As if in a dream, I watched him take aim, fire, and turned to see a splash of water beside a boat, or a man scream and grab his chest, lurching backward. The soldier's expression was calm, indifferent. I stared at him for what seemed minutes, but could only have been a few seconds. A small body came out of the water in Randall's arms, and he passed it to me. I immediately laid it on the forward bench and began artificial respiration. It was a young boy. His skin was warm and his eyes open, staring. I dreaded he was already dead. But after a few of my puffed breaths, he shut his eyes tight, coughed up water and vomited, and started to breathe, and then to scream and thrash. I spat the sour taste of vomit from my mouth and handed him to an older boy who cradled him in a skinny lap. I looked up, took another child from Shatrow and then another, and saw that our launch held too many, was in danger of tipping over itself. We had drifted with the current past the flatboats. A few men still huddled on the decks, but most had retreated within the cabins. The soldier with the rifle had been shot and lay over the gunwale, blood dripping from his ruined head into the river. A few shots still rang out, from the boats and from the shore, but the children were the main concern of most of the citizens. Randall gave Shatrow the tiller again, and shouted at Larissa to help keep the children calm. She did not move. The launch carried perhaps 25 boys and girls, the youngest barely 2, the oldest 12 or 13, all terrified, pasty white or olive green with shock. A small boy's body lay in the bottom of the boat, staring with the slack, empty look of the dead. The boat smelled of fear and urine and vomit. "Put into shore," Randall told Shatrow. "Omi, help me get these children to the port side, to the left." I helped rearrange 5 of the youngsters, moving them bodily if they were too stunned or frightened to respond. The launch ran up onto a small black sand beach, nearly knocking me off my feet. A tall, wiry, older girl fell into the water and clambered ashore on her own, hair streaming sand and water, face set with determination to stay alive and get away from the madness. 3 women and 2 men came out of the silva behind the beach and helped us unload the children. "Where are they from?" a matronly, tall woman with graying hair asked. She gripped 2 children by their arms. One kicked his feet in the water and began to scream. "I don't know," Shatrow answered. "From Moonrise, perhaps," Randall suggested. How many villages had had their children stolen? A man in soaked brown pants and clinging white shirt swam to the beach and stood in the shallows, lurching ashore. He glanced at us, saw we were busy tending to the children, and tried to run into the Silva, but two strong young men in war kits carrying large sticks blocked his path. "Who are you?" one asked him. "I give up," he said breathlessly. They took him away, whacking him on the shoulders and back with their fists. The children were led or walked on their own back into the Silva, and the launch bobbed gently in the water now that it was lighter, beginning to come around stern first and pull off the beach. A single boy of 5 or 6 had stayed in the boat. He gripped the gunwale with both hands and looked over his shoulder at me.
"My name is Daniel Harran," he said. "My family is dead. Where do I go?"
Other than the dead boy still in the bottom, he was the last in our care. I sat beside him and put an arm around his shoulder. "We'll find you a place, Daniel," I said. Larissa had somehow managed to get ashore, where she squatted on the sand, as helpless and useless as ever. I felt a sudden flash of hate mixed with pity for her. So many primitive emotions in 1 hour. I felt drained. Randall moored the boat with a line and anchor, and stood in the water beside us, staring at me and the boy. "Where have we gone so wrong?" he asked. 4. Calcutta rose along the scallops and harbors of the west bank like a magnificent card castle, more lovely than I expected. Yellow and white walls rose from the surrounding red and black and pink Silva. The late afternoon sun burnished the tops of the low, planar, angular buildings like white gold. The walls merged with steps descending past level parks and warehouses to the river, where the waters slopped and slid. As the boat cruised past the outlying sections of the city, if it could be called a city having less than 5,000 residents, I saw that most of the buildings were made of painted sila, probably lisbu or cathedral tree. Foundations and retaining walls were concrete and granite. Of steel and plastic I saw little. Broad glass windows faced the east and the river. That meant furnaces and manufacturing. The launch passed a few other boats. Shatro and Randall sat in the rear. Larissa back beneath the shade, and I took the bench near the bow. We had been relieved of the dead boy, and we had cleaned the bottom of the boat as best we could with buckets of water and rags. I could not clear my head of the sounds and smells. Vomit from the boy I had breathed life back into stained my shirt and pants. Parts of me still saw and analyzed, but the center of my thoughts was a numb grayness. I could not sleep yet, but I wanted to fall asleep. The closest I could come to sleep was to sit on the bench and stare and try not to remember too clearly. I had never felt strong parental instincts until I saw the children in the water. Now, behind the grayness, flashes of horror and unconditional love for the children and animal hatred, the urge to wrap my hands around the necks of the Bryanists, all came and went like lightning behind clouds. I would have to work hard to keep my objectivity. My mission was to study Lamarckia, not to become involved in immigrant politics. The tallest building rose from the city's center on a low hill, 4 rounded stories, each eccentric from a central axis, beneath cantilevered pagoda roofs and porches that to me seemed lovely, if ancient. Frank Lloyd Wright, Richard Neutra, I thought. A touch of Tibet. Shangri-La. Trying to remember fragments of terrestrial art history that I had explored before all my memory supplements had been removed. The missing information bothered me. I shuddered slightly, stumbling onto a lapse in some personal wisdom based on memory no longer accessible, like a missing molar. I hated that sensation. It made me feel reduced, less capable. It shook my confidence. What if I lurched into a crucial gap during an emergency? But none of this really mattered compared to what we had just experienced. The launch slid smoothly into a covered berth at the municipal dock. As Shatro secured the lines, I climbed out of the boat and took a deep breath, turned, and found Randall staring at me blankly. Suddenly he smiled. He looked like a wolf. "We did some good back there," he said. We'll go to the court tomorrow and let them know you're here. You can stay with my family tonight. Larissa came out from under the shade, stiff with dignity or perhaps exhaustion. She barely looked at us.
I have family here, she said. I do not need your help.
Thomas wants you at the court, Randall reminded her. She nodded.
I will be there.
She glared at me. Her eyelids drew together and her face seemed full of hatred.
I do not need your help.
We walked through the center of Calcutta to Randall's home. Shatro said his farewells and went off to his own home. He was unbonded, Randall said, and lived with an older man and woman in the Karpos neighborhood. They raise fruits there. Pears and apples do well if you grind up Lisbu parasols for fertilizer. They naturally give up the right nutrients for those trees. It's a luxury crop, but that's nothing against it. The courthouse, center of the district's legal proceedings, sat just below the elegant tower on Calcutta's highest hill. We walked up a long, winding flight of steps lined with homes and shops. The tower, Randall said, was the Lenk hub, seat of cross-district government and home of Lenk himself when he chose to come to Calcutta. It's really quite spare quarters for such a fine man, Randall said. Do you know him? I asked. Through Captain Kaiser Bach. The broad steps were caught in afternoon shadow, which seemed richly brown, almost golden beneath the silver sky. The city smelled of cooking food, mostly yeasty bread smells and rich molasses smells, dust from carts rolling on the busy street below, orange and tomato and spice from the Silva never completely absent. Children ran laughing and shrieking down the steps beside us. Boys and girls from late infancy to middle childhood, wearing red shorts and white vests with green vertical stripes, tended by a young man with a bemused look, no doubt junior husband in a triad. Otherwise the streets were quiet, the citizens polite, their clothes muted, generally browns and grays or greens, each, however, with one splash of color, a scarf or sash or belt, signifying solemnity within living joy. These traditions had held up well on Lamarckia. I was relieved that not everything had fallen into chaos. After all I had heard of famine and hardship, I was surprised that Calcutta looked prosperous and its citizens well-fed. At the top of the stairs, in a shaded courtyard graced with a single terrestrial tree, an ash, I thought, its limbs bare, not faring very well, we turned into a narrow alley. The houses that rose on either side were made of cut reddish lava held together by dark gray cement. An anonymous Xyla doorway, no different from the others, pushed open with a creak at Randall's touch, and we entered cool shadow.
Randall?
A woman called eagerly.
Erwin, is that you?
That's me, Randall said. He smiled shyly, the wolf look gone. That's my wife, Raitha. Head of family. I'm an infrequent extra here. Randall's family totaled 7. 4 children, age 2 to 12, 2 younger girls and 2 older boys, who flocked around him with broad smiles and big eyes, simply glad to see their father. His wife, Raitha, a plump, pretty woman the same age as he, and her mother, Keitai Kimjastro. Ser Kimjastro was tall and straight and gray and formidable, and she did not hug Randall, but instead shook his hand and welcomed him back with deep gravity. The children gathered around me when they were finished welcoming their father. They asked where I was from and whether I was married and had any children and why their father had brought me home with him. Randall answered the last question by saying, "He's a researcher and he's our guest. He's not used to a lot of company, so please give him some room until after dinner at least." The 2 older boys stayed to hear Randall's stories, but the younger girls went with their mother and grandmother into another room down the hall. I heard other voices in that room, a communal kitchen. Men from another family in the triad were cooking today.
"Nothing fancy," Raitha said as she walked down the hall flanked by her girls. "But it's food."
"More gray piscids and flockwheat paste," Randall said when she had left, and confided another grimace. He led me into a room he said was his own and his alone, but he did not object when the boys followed. This tiny cubicle had a window high in one wall to the outside, through which a cool evening breeze was blowing. A small electric lantern hung in one corner, casting a dim yellow light over shelves packed with crudely bound books.
"Father, what happened at the river?"
the older of the two boys asked as we settled onto woven fiber chairs.
"The teacher dismissed us early today and went to the river. He said he was joining a committee."
"There was a fight," Randall said, lines growing deeper in his face. He did not like describing this to his sons.
"Did anybody get killed?"
the younger boy asked. He reminded me of the boy I had saved by breathing life back into him. His eyes danced with intense interest. My stomach knotted with the remembered love and hate all over again. "A lot of people were killed, mostly pirates," Randall said. He did not volunteer information about the children in the boats. A bell jangled near the alleyway door, and Randall got up to answer it. After a conversation of several minutes, during which time the boys sat in the room alone with me, biting their lips and staring at each other for support but saying nothing, Randall returned. "A representative of the citizens' rank welcoming me back," Randall said. "Thomas radioed them from upriver. They will indeed expect us tomorrow."
"Any more news?" the older boy asked.
"Sir Olmi, let me name these chatty ones for you," he said, patting their heads. "This is Nebulon, and this is Carl. Carl is a year and a half younger than his brother."
"I made my mother a little sick," Carl said. "That's why our sisters are so new and we're not."
"There's more news, yes," Randall said, eyes half closed with exhaustion. "Go help your mother and grandmother. I'll tell you later."
"Now,"
Carl insisted, but Randall gently and firmly packed them out of the room and drew the curtains once they were down the hall and out of hearing. "There were 37 children on the boat," Randall said. 30 of them were saved. We had most of them in our boat. 12 of the Bryanists died and 20 were wounded. 60 are in custody. Nobody knows what to do with them. They'll probably be sent to Athenai for Lenk to decide. We can't afford to keep them here." He took a deep breath and lifted his arms. "Pardon me, I'm acting as if we're old friends." "We've been through a lot," I said. "But I don't know you. That's unusual around here. Most people know each other along the Terra Nova." "I've been a loner most of my life." "Because your family was proscribed?" I put on an air of ignoring this, and Randall assumed he had touched on a sensitive issue. "You showed real courage on the river today," he said. "Even more than Shatro. You seem accustomed to this kind of incident." "I'm not," I said truthfully. "And I wouldn't call it courage." "Hum," Randall muttered and sat down in his chair, stretching his legs out in the small, close, brown, and shadowy room. "Still, you impress me. What prospects do you have? What plans, if I may continue this ungrateful prying?" "I need to get to Athenai at some point," I said. "How soon?" Randall asked. "I'm not sure." "I'm asking because my partner, Captain Kaiser Bach," he paused to gauge my reaction to that name. I pursed my lips and widened my eyes, and that seemed to satisfy him. "And I are about to begin a very ambitious journey by ship. We've overcome many difficulties and many kinds of reluctance, both to get this journey financed and approved, and to find the right people to go with us." I saw that the name of Captain Kaiser Bach was meant to impress me, but though he had mentioned it once before, I knew nothing about this person. I decided to behave as if I were impressed. "A journey to where?" I asked. "A circumnavigation," Randall said. "We hope to finish the voyage Jittermeier and Baker and Chilago never completed. To Jakarta first, then to Wallace Station to pick up Sir Mansur Salap and more researchers, then across the Darwin Sea northeast to Martha's Island. That's just the beginning. A circumnavigation from east to west. We'll end up in Athenai, but it might take us 3 years." I felt my chest tighten. "That's a grand voyage," I said. "A scientific expedition?" Randall cringed, and I realized my mistake too late. "The captain uses that word much too often, and in the wrong company," he said. "For us, it is always research, and we are researchers. But it amounts to the same thing. We've studied Liz enough for the time being. She's a wonderful ecos, peaceful and nurturing once we knew her ways. But she's a little bland and uniform for our tastes. It's time to make comparisons and draw broad conclusions. Otherwise, both the captain and I firmly believe In time, Lamarckia is going to kill us. He lowered his voice. We came here ignorant and unprepared, and it has taken all these decades to even begin to climb out of the hole. Now he stared at me, earnestly, large liquid eyes penetrating, measuring, still more than a little doubtful. Whom will you report to, I asked, when you finish the voyage? To Abel Lenk himself, Randall said. I stared at my hands, almost too tired and numb to realize my fortune. Rye Ornis had truly put me at a locus of extreme interest. If it fits within your plans, you're welcome to interview with the captain, and I'll back you up. But no need to answer right away. We both need rest, and you have to testify tomorrow. The offer is very interesting, I said. That's enough for now, Randall said, lifting his hands from the arm of the woven chair. We should wash ourselves before dinner. We deserve a brave meal and a few glasses of wine. As I splashed water on my face from a ceramic bowl in a cramped washroom, I saw clearly again the Bryanist soldier on the flatboat, kneeling and taking careful aim at the rescuers in their canoes and dinghies. His expression haunted me more than his death, which I did not witness. He seemed perfectly content to be killing people, even those who were not trying to kill him. He squinted one eye and aimed his pitiful rifle as if it might be the most powerful weapon in the universe. For the people he killed, of course, it was. But I had seen weapons that could scour a million hectares and reduce matter to blue-violet plasma. I looked up at the little unframed mirror on the wall and wondered just why this thought had occurred to me. The soldier on the flatboat had become a tool, and this man, this dead man, had been content to be such a tool. He did not think whether it was right or wrong to shoot men and women in boats trying to save children he himself had kidnapped. I wondered whether there was not a little of him in me. What would I do with this anger, this wish that I myself had put my hands around the man's neck and strangled him, watching his flat, contented eyes go blank and slack as the eyes of the boy in the bottom of the boat? Not your job, I whispered to the image in the mirror. Black hair, sharp eyes, sharp nose, large lips that seemed a little insolent even to me. Just learn what you can, get the clavicle. Go home. The eight of us sat down at a long Lisbu table to ladle helpings from several bowls of flockwheat paste and baked biscuits from the river. Gray-skinned, mouthless, fish-like creatures with translucent fringed tails, three black eye spots, and a body about 20 centimeters long. They consisted almost entirely of ropey, muscle-like proteins that were nourishing but tasteless. Various sauces, concocted from a private herb garden, added some zest to a very bland meal. It was apparent within the first few minutes of dinner that Ser Kaytai Kimjastro thought she was the head of this branch of the triad. Randall and his wife treated her with quiet deference, and the children did likewise, but it was obvious that nobody treated her quite as well as she thought she deserved. As we settled down to eat, she picked at her food with sad dignity, like deposed royalty dreaming of past feasts. This did not seem to bother Raytha, who had not cooked the food this day, taking the family share from the communal kitchen. There was little talk of the action on the river. Instead, Raytha asked her husband about the journey upriver and what they had found. Randall described 12 previously uncatalogued scions. "Not new ones. They don't have the marks of prototypes or test cases, but we've just never observed them and recorded them at the same time. We made a great many oxygen measurements. No signs of a fluxing."
"Was it worthwhile as a trip?" Raytha asked.
"I think so. Not nearly as worthwhile as the big voyage, of course, but good exercise."
"My husband gets restless if he spends more than a few days a month at home," Raytha said to me cheerfully.
Randall smiled and inclined his head as if showing modesty at some compliment. "My wife gets restless if I'm underfoot," he responded.
"We like having Da home," the youngest boy, Carl, said.
Carl was eating very little. I found the children's faces mesmerizing. The girls in particular were enchanting, little mimics of the adult women, lisps and childish accents like music. The children in the river had affected me more deeply than I realized.
"Why are you staring at us?"
the oldest girl, Sasti, asked after a few minutes. "I've been out in the silver for so long," I said. "Not many young, beautiful faces out there."
"Our children are very attractive," Raitha said proudly.
"Not well-behaved all the time, but attractive."
"Thank you, Mima,"
Sasti said primly.
"Would it be polite to ask about your work?" Raitha asked me.
"Much like Sarah Randall's, only less educated and much less directed. Largely a waste of 2 years, actually." Randall gave a quick warning look to Raitha, who caught it and redirected her line of questioning.
"And your present plans?"
"I need to find work. I thought I would go to Athenai." Raitha's mother shook her head.
"A snobbish town, if ever there was one. Everybody bows to Abel Link. I came here from Athenai to be with my daughter when her children were born. My husband is still there."
"Katai's views are a bit harsh," Raitha said.
"She lived close to the throne too long."
Randall said in an undertone, "Be kind. Remember, we have the funding and approval."
"Yes, well, it took good Lenk 7 years to give it to you," Katai said. "I don't fear spies. I know Lenk doesn't go in for them, for one thing. This is not a police state, and I give him credit where it's due. And besides, Ser Olmi does not have the look of an informer."
"I wouldn't know who to talk to," I said. "I don't know much about politics in Athenai."
"It's a political town, but that's hardly abnormal," Katai continued. "Few criticize good Lenk, even when there is much to criticize. If more criticism had been given at the beginning, perhaps we wouldn't have experienced so much hardship and tragedy."
"The crossing through the way was very difficult to arrange," Raitha said with a hint of piety. "So I understand, of course. I hadn't been born."
"Tell us more about Thistle down in the way, Granmi," Nebulon said, but she ignored him. "I was an adult," Katai said. "I should have known what I was getting into. But living in Thistledown was a dream of luxury, and we weren't prepared. Nobody knew what to expect. Least of all did we know we'd be turned into baby machines."
"That phrase again." "Law of nature," Randall said dryly.
"Easy for men to say," Katai continued, warming to her subject. "And for Link to expect of us. And we agreed. It sounded dramatic and powerful, to become mothers to a new and cleaner society. But what happened on the river today, was that clean or honorable?"
"What the defenders did was honorable," Raitha said, cheeks pinking. She glanced at Randall, but he was used to his in-law, apparently, and was studiously taking no offense.
"Did you see all bravery and no foolishness, Ser Olmi?" Katai asked.
"I saw bravery and a lot of foolishness," I said.
"A lot of foolishness, that's true enough. We need to be brave with so much foolishness."
She sat silent for a while, and we finished the dinner with little but the chatter of the children. Nebulon described Thistledown and the way for me, and Carl added telling details. They thought it was a fabulous place, full of cold, pounding machines and people who no longer looked like people. Katai picked up where she had left off as herb tea was served.
"I remember Thistledown well," she said. "Nobody else here remembers it at all."
"I was 3 years old," Randall said. "Not very clear memories."
"It was not what Link portrays, nor what Carl and Nebulon make up. It was not a corrupting place of technological hubris. It was wonderfully comfortable and fulfilling. I did not realize it at the time. I was a young idealist. My husband was a devoted follower of good Link. Everything my husband believed, I believed. And for his sake, I crossed. Three of my children died in the first 3 years. I bore those children in misery and pain, and they died. On Thistledown, their births would have been much easier, and they would not have died."
"The price we paid was high," Raitha said softly, sipping from her ceramic cup and staring at the top of the table. "But we've gained a beautiful world, a young world."
She seemed embarrassed by her mother's talk, but was not going to cut it short. I wondered how much she agreed with it, and how much Randall agreed, and how much the general population of immigrants resented the difficulties of the past few decades.
How many worlds have been opened in the way by now? Almost 40 years? We might have each found a paradise.
Kate, I thought that time passed on Thistledown as it did here.
But we hated the technology. We feared it. We feared it so much we left most of it behind, even the machines that would have kept our children alive. Everything fell upon the women, making babies and watching them die. The old ways, forgotten by all of us. We were not prepared for them, I remember.
The way was monstrous, Raitha said.
Link used the way, didn't he?
Kate, I said.
Mother, our guest has had a very difficult day, and so has Erwin. We should find other things to talk about. The day's difficulties are part of what I can't even begin to express. Someday it will all be set right, but I do not know how.
I apologize, Serolmi, if I've upset you.
Not upset at all, I said.
Kaitai gave me the first smile I had seen on her face.
I'd like to tell you about Thistledown sometime, she said. You're much too young to remember, and there's so much distortion of the facts.
I remember it the way it really was, when I was a girl, before I met my husband.
Randall and Raitha prepared a cot for me in the study. Feel free to consult the books, Randall said.
We often have scholars stay with us, Raitha said.
Randall likes to show off his library.
Not many as good outside of Athenai or Jakarta, Randall said. Almost everything known about Lamarckia. He shook his head ruefully. Obviously, there's a lot left to learn.
The family retired a few minutes later, and the apartment fell quiet. My exhaustion had passed, and I sat up on the cot, wide awake. I had the entire evening ahead of me while the family slept. Fingers tapped lightly on the frame beside the drawn curtain. I pulled the curtain aside. Kaitai stood in the hall, fingers to her lips, gray eyes glistening in the dark.
"You seem sympathetic," she said. "I get so little sympathy here. Oh, there's much love, but nobody seems to understand."
Irritated that I might have less time to study the slate or the books, I pulled the curtain aside and invited her in.
"I do feel I have something to tell," she said stiffly, glancing at the walls of books with no interest whatsoever. "Erwin will take you away tomorrow, and I'll probably not have another chance. You spent 2 years in the Silva. I have no doubt you found it fascinating and maybe even beautiful. It is beautiful, I can't deny that. But on Thistledown, there were chambers filled with terrestrial forests, animals, insects, rich and dense and complete. When I was a girl, we would spend weeks in the forests, and unless we looked up into the sky, we could pretend we were back on Earth. Lovely, lovely places. My husband told me Lamarckia would be a paradise. He assured me Lenk knew everything, and that we would live in pristine wilderness never visited by humans. I don't think even he understood what that would mean. Lenk told us to procreate. I spent the first 10 years here having babies and watching most of them die. Raitha was my fourth, and the first to live. The soil was poor in cobalt and selenium and magnesium. None of our crops grew properly. We didn't know which things to eat on Lamarckia. The food was wrong. Adults became sick as well, but not as often as the children. Their little bodies didn't seem to know how to fit in. Those were terrible times. We suffered diseases never known on Thistledown. We were not prepared.
Raitha stood in the doorway.
Mother, she said gently, please, our guest is very tired.
I just wanted to tell him, Kaitai said.
I'm sorry, Serolmi,
Raitha said, putting her arm around her mother's shoulder. She turned her head to look at me.
I don't disagree with my mother, but there are better times to talk, and we haven't even asked what your views are.
He's young, Kaitai said. He should know. Who will tell him?
Raitha drew the curtain, and the apartment became quiet again. I took Nequano's slate from the backpack. The walls of books were too formidable. High-level texts, papers written by researchers for other researchers. I had to prepare myself with basic knowledge before I tackled them. But by morning I had to be ready for further conversations with Randall and with his friend, the important and well-known Captain Kaiserbach. I studied Nequano's personal files again, trying to piece together the clues to unravel his code. There were many bookmarks in texts by Henry David Thoreau, laid in with quotes from Henry Place, the head ecologist during the construction of Thistledown. I tried combinations of these names and of various titles as keys, without success. Then, half by accident, I found a highlighted passage from Thoreau. "What is a country without rabbits and partridges? They are among the most simple and indigenous animal products, ancient and venerable families known to antiquity as to modern times. Of the very hue and substance of nature, nearest allied to leaves and to the ground." After the quote, a laid-in note from Nequano, "Thoreau has the earth in him. Unless you know where you are, you don't know who you are." Place, I thought. Rabbits, partridges. Place, country. Thoreau, rabbits. Thoreau has the earth in him, not had, but has. I tapped the slate against my knee, getting more and more irritated. It was right in front of me. I knew it. Earth, Thoreau. I saw the letters and matched them name to name. Thoreau did indeed contain earth, with O and U left over. U-O, O-U, O. I checked the dictionaries in the slate for O and U and U and O. O, the slate told me, was French for where. Unless you know where you are, you don't know who you are. That was a quote from a 20th century author named Wendell Berry, often used by citizens of Thistledown. The slate's simple computer was tracking my searches, a small icon revealed. I felt as if Nequano watched over my shoulder as I riddled his little puzzle. I keyed in Earth, Where, Place, Thoreau, Berry. A box suddenly popped up on the screen of the slate. "Do you know the place where Thoreau is buried?" I entered Earth. The box wrote in new text, "Thoreau is in the earth is in Thoreau, but where is Thoreau buried?" I went to the old Greater Starship Encyclopedia that had come as standard issue with these slates when they had been made, reproductions of 20th century antiques, for divaricates on Thistledown. The slate had lasted all these years. I wondered how many 20th century batteries had been brought with the immigrants for their special humble slates, but there was no place to remove batteries and replace them. As I searched the encyclopedia for entries on Thoreau, I realized that the slates must have been equipped with contemporary power supplies which could last centuries. Divaricates often made such choices after careful consideration with their philosophical leaders. The usual dispensation for modern technology was given following the phrase, "The good man would have approved of this, for it is human-centered and does not make us less than what we are." I could not disagree that Nequano's slate was human-centered. There was no specific answer as to where Thoreau was buried in the encyclopedia, or anywhere else in the slate's references, but it did say that he had last lived in Boston. I keyed in Boston, Massachusetts. "Access given," the slate replied. I now had Nequano's personal journals open to me. I remembered his smooth musical conversation when I had met him as a child on Thistledown, and even then his keen intellect had impressed me. I knew I would find some of the perspective and clues I needed. I began with entries from more than 30 Lamarckian years before. Crossing 4, Fall 67. Much discussion today about Lenk's plan to formalize our search for edible scions. From his perch in Jakarta, Lenk listens to his various lieutenants and suddenly realizes how hungry we at the edge of the human territories are. Everybody is hungry. The crops do not grow fast enough, nor in sufficient quantity. Harvests are poor. The soil is metal poor, and that includes trace minerals. We eat scions in desperation, and some of us have sickened and died. We know that white hats, so we have named the slow, flat, three-cornered scions that walk on their downturned tips, are not edible, yet two of Moonrise's children have died in the last week trying to eat one. Some successes. For a long time we have trimmed mat fiber from low-growth broadfan epidendrids, which prosper near Moonrise, and use it as a kind of tea and in making fabric. Chewing it provides some satisfaction. It contains a mild elevant, not yet isolated by our chemists, but little nutrition. The most successful food we've discovered so far is a pulpy paste made from the thick pelt of purple and red tendrils on the so-called asparagus phytid. The pelt regrows quickly, the paste tastes like mild fish, and it provides substantial protein. No one has yet analyzed all the phytids, and it is likely that some of what we eat may hurt us later. But for now, hunger rules, especially in places like Moonrise, on the edge of Lenk's domain. Crossing 7, Spring 78. The first 2 years after Abel Lenk brought us all here, I remember the Silva would sing every night. It sang a gentle, whistling, whooping song, the arborids drawing air through slits on parasol leaves, other scions making their own unique sounds like instruments in an orchestra. Nobody knew why the Silva sang. It just did, and we accepted it and grew used to it. But as the years passed, the night song declined. Some nights, the Silva would produce only a few scattered sounds, haunting and lonely. Some nights, there would be no singing at all. Now the Silva sings perhaps once every 10 days. I think I understand why it sings, but I do not know why it does so less frequently. The Ecos must have many ways to keep track of its scions. We have seen speeders on their accustomed trails through the Silva, like three-legged greyhounds zipping between the phytids and arborids at speeds up to 30 kilometers an hour. We know some of the paths of gliders and avids who swoop above the Silva. I believe, and I'm not alone, that all of these creatures play a role in the Ecos's internal communication. Like messengers, they carry information, perhaps about conditions in the south or the north, about intrusions from other zones, or just general gossip. They carry them somewhere. Something listens, considers, contemplates. Or so I hope. I would like to meet the heart and mind of an Ecos. I have many questions to ask of her, or it. Crossing 8, Spring 43. Today I saw a herd of parasol sweepers, like great two-headed giraffes, pushing through the Silva half a kilometer outside Moonrise and a few dozen meters from the river. Infrequently see them in daylight, and never in such numbers and of such size. One was tall enough to touch the brushes of a cathedral tree. I wondered if the Ecos was reassigning them to another region. They moved on three parallel tracks like the feet of slugs. On close inspection, when Hilaire killed a small one by accident with a tractor one night, each track reveals itself as a parade of thousands of sucker-tipped feet, each no more than an inch long, yet supporting the weight of these creatures large as Earth's dinosaurs, and bearing them some resemblance. They do not ingest, I hesitate to say eat, the parasols or fan leaves, unless the stalks have been injured, perhaps by wind, or are otherwise not functioning. When we first arrived, some of us thought these were herbivores, as we might expect on an Earth savanna or in a jungle. Now we know much more about them, yet not nearly enough. Also today, saw many white hats feeding from a lisbu, like aphids on a rose stem. They remained there for hours, but usually feed in a few seconds, then leave. No one knows what purpose the white hats serve. Received a package of documents from Jakarta today. The reconvened Research Standards Convention has finally decided on classifications and nomenclature for Lamarckian biology. We must deviate substantially from old terrestrial standards for obvious reasons. There seems to be no higher classification than an Ecos. Ecoi will be described and defined by geographic location or the name of the discoverer and a zone number, e.g. Elizabeth's Zone or Zone 1. Determination of boundaries and proof of relationship to an ecos will depend on observations and genetic analysis, the latter still crude and uncertain. Observation seems to be the principal and most reliable method for the time being. Clades within ecoi come next. Arborids or tree-like clades, phytids, annulids, polygonids, etc. define these groups of scions. Next come related scions, or forms that vary little in design. Thus, white hats are classified as Elizabethae polygonon trigonikos. No doubt the classifications and nomenclature will change and improve, but at least we have reached some agreement on how to begin. I skipped ahead, scrolling rapidly through the hundreds of pages of text. Crossing 22, Winter 34. My wife has been dead for almost 20 years, and I have not remarried. I began this journal when she died. Women have borne the brunt of our coming to Lamarckia. We live our philosophies with a vengeance now, and deep are the hurts and regrets. Some say deeper still the satisfactions. But I remember my wife and her gentle ways, and the dismay on her face at the pain of birthing our first child. I felt so much pain myself that my lust, my insistence, should put her in this state. There was, of course, her recovery and joy after. But I can't help but think the women look back on our time in Thistledown and feel regret at what they left behind. It is because of their true courage that they don't complain more. My wife's time came far too early. Something failed within her, and she just died. Death can arrive a simple friend for those who die. It is never simple for those who survive. Crossing 23, Summer 7. With the village children from the Lenk school, I have walked through the Silva. We have captured scions and brought them back to the school for study, always releasing them within a few hours. The most poignant capture for me was last week. William Tass Fenny, age 8, found a small six-legged transporter with 7 young phytids. At this early stage, Elizabeth's phytids, especially the smaller ones we call sprouts, are little more than blobs of dark gray or purple gelatin the size of a finger, filled throughout with tiny white threads. William brought the transporter back to our school in a cart. We looked at the wriggling bowl with its leathery lid, and at the young phytids within, and made our notes. I then told William to take it back to where he had found it, and he said, "But I don't remember where that was." We tried to walk back along some trail into the Silva, but William had left few marks, and his cart's wheel tracks had vanished in the springy soil. Finally, with less and less of the day to spare and lessons on other subjects beginning soon, we placed the transporter and its cargo on the Silva floor. It turned in a circle several times, emitted a small sigh, and fell to the ground. Then it dumped its load of phytids. They lay like finger-sized worms, wriggling on the dark, clumpy earth. Angela called from the school building, so I took the children back, but vowed to return as soon as I could. A few hours later, I found the transporter in a morbid condition, and all the young phytids desiccated and crumbling. We had interfered with the transporter's simple instructions, or removed it from a track, scented or otherwise marked, and replaced it where it did not belong. I think often of that carrier. What of our own children, removed from their track? Crossing 25, Winter 15. Joseph Vissel visits again from Calcutta. He came from Athenai and arrived in Calcutta just yesterday, then took the Wednesday boat immediately to Moonrise. We have spent many hours the past evenings catching up. In the daytime he travels with his researcher friends farther south along the river, but they always return by dusk. I fear none of them are more than dilettantes, but they take joy in their small discoveries, some of which may be valuable. He brings more details of the attempted assassination of Abel Lenk, news of which horrified us all 2 weeks ago when we first heard it on the radio. The would-be assassin belongs to the Gaians, a group much rumored and about which little has ever been learned, making me think perhaps they are more legend than fact. But this would-be assassin, Daw Tone Kunstler, whom I have never met, claims to be one of them. Joseph tells me that the Guyans are active everywhere and know each other by secret signs. Quaint. We left Thistledown to create a new kind of heaven, and instead find ourselves on roads to old, insipid hells. Joseph also brings word that Link is approving a new research program against the advice of his counselors, particularly Alrika Fasid, a small woman who is a formidable adversary. For once, Link does not listen to her. The program will be called the Lamarckian Year, and all communities will participate, by which they must mean allocate resources to some central distribution point. There will be much protest. Our resources are still scarce, though the famine has passed. I suppose we may sacrifice a tractor and send it to Athenai. A new exploring expedition will begin, led by Baker and Shulago, two of my former students at Jakarta. They are brilliant but argumentative, and I fear they may not be good leaders. After a dozen entries in the Quano's journal, I went to the shelves of books and found two thick volumes, introductory texts that were not filled with technical terms and words I could not easily cross-reference. They would serve well enough as introductions to what the immigrants knew about Lamarckia, or at least about Liz. I read all that night, until just before dawn, when I grew restless and my muscles began to cramp. As in Thistledown, there were no locks on the doors. I stole out quietly and walked north up the alley. I needed to see Calcutta alone and think about what I had read. I had not counted on the profound darkness of Calcutta in the early morning hours. No electric lights burned along the alley or on the streets outside, and only a few were visible on the hills below. Clouds had moved in over the river delta, and not even the starlight helped. I felt my way back down the alley, counting doors, fingers scuffing rough lava brick and the grain of the Lisbu in the doorposts and doors, until I came back to what I thought must be Randall's. With some relief, I lay on my cot in the library and considered all the simple things I would have to learn. 5. Randall accompanied me the half-kilometer from his house to the court building below the Link Hub. We passed through a crowd of angry, curious citizens. Some of them recognized Randall and me from the engagement on the river and clapped us on our backs, expressing their thanks and congratulations. We came to a cordon of court security guards, and the officer in charge checked our names and let us through. Outside the main courtroom, a group of 5 citizens rank, two grim-faced older men and 3 women past childbearing years greeted us stiffly. Before hearing our testimony, they were taking a short break in the annex, standing in their dark gray robes and sipping matte fiber tea. They had been busy since dawn that morning ruling on how and when to send the captured Bryanists to Athenai for Link's disposition. Larissa Strick-Cashamu sat on a bench nearby, alone and silent. The last of the Bryanists to be arraigned that day were led out of the court as we arrived, 7 men and a woman, all wearing the clothes they had worn the day before, though dried and cleaned for them, all trussed neck to neck and foot to foot with thick ropes. Iron and steel were too valuable for chains, and I suspected there was little need for chains in Calcutta. The crowd outside began to shout and jeer as the prisoners came in sight. Their guards guided them swiftly down an open alley and away from the hub complex. A few minutes after we arrived, the disciplinary Elevi Bar Thomas and 2 of his deputies walked into the annex. Thomas nodded at Randall, Larissa, and me, and walked closer. "I hear we both had a skirmish," he said. "We met the 3 flatboats snagged above Calcutta. They passed us upriver. A few shots were fired, but we knew we couldn't stop them." "Did you wait for the other boats?" Randall asked. "Until last night. Then I decided it was useless, and we came back to Calcutta." Randall was not impressed by this story, but he did not say anything critical. "The citizens did well here," Thomas said. "I wish I could have been here to help them." After 5 minutes, the clerk announced the citizens' rank would reconvene. Randall excused himself and invited me to come down to the vigilant at the docks after and meet Captain Kaiserbach. The rest of us moved into an interior, windowless room brightly illuminated by electric incandescents. Here the city smells lapsed into mustiness and stale air. The citizens' rank took 5 chairs on a low dais. Thomas stood beside them, facing Larissa and me. Larissa rose from her cot and sat gingerly on a chair.
"What are her injuries?"
asked the eldest woman with a sympathetic tone. Her name was Sulamit Fei Chinmoy. Small, lean-faced, her hands wrinkled and bones showing in fine ridges beneath ivory skin, she focused her attention on Larissa, brow wrinkled in concern.
"Grief and shock," Larissa replied sharply. "Betrayal."
"Exhaustion," Thomas added. "Days without food."
"Are you strong enough to tell your story?"
Larissa rolled her eyes and clenched her jaw muscles.
"I've told already. It hurts to chew on it again and again."
"We understand," the eldest woman said.
"Do you recognize me, Larissa Strikashimu?"
"No," Larissa said.
"I married you to your husband 10 years ago."
"Then I curse you," Larissa said. The woman drew back in some surprise.
"We should identify ourselves formally," she said.
One by one, the citizens' rank gave their names and residences in the city. The youngest male, a broad-hipped, narrow-shouldered man with a pinched, nosy face and searching, deep-set eyes, said he was from Jakarta, servant in courtesy to Calcutta by rank exchange. His name was Terence Rai Pascal, and he seemed particularly interested in me.
"Please tell your story to us," said a tall, long-fingered man with thick black hair and large blue eyes. "Kenneth Duchamet of South City, a farmer. And remember, under the creed of the good man and Link's law, every citizen speaks before a legally convened 5 as if sworn under sacred oath."
The oath assumed that none should ever feel free to lie, I remembered. That I would almost certainly violate this brought a sudden and unexpected pang. Larissa gave her testimony, slowly, painfully. She drew herself upright in her chair several times as she told of her husband's meeting with the Bryanists and of his leaving with them 2 seasons before. Then she spoke of the boats that returned and of the Bryanist soldiers. She used the old term of disdain, soldaters, created just after the death 10 centuries before, and her words hissed forth like air from a deflating balloon. Weak, exhausted, she slumped in the chair, face twisted and wet with tears.
"The mayor turned down the representative of General Bays. I hid when they came. I knew they would do bad things."
Drawing herself up again, she spoke of searching the village, finding no one alive, hiding again for a time, then wandering to the river to wait for boats. There she had found the last victims, Nkwano, her cousin Gennadia, and the other 2. Then she described my appearance on the dock.
"He came out of nowhere. Everything he said was a lie."
She asked forcefully why the boats had not come earlier. Fei Chinmoy said in reedy tones,
"Because your village was not missed until radios went unanswered for a day and a half. Normally, boats go there from Calcutta once every 5 days."
"We've explained this to her," Thomas said in an undertone.
"Don't condescend to me! I am a thinking human being," Larissa erupted, rising.
I looked away, feeling a quick flush on my cheeks. Distress at her distress, at this whole proceeding. Why did these people affect me so? I felt as if I were looking back 9 centuries in time to the recovery, falling into an older kind of history, the adolescence of humanity with all its snares and barbs.
"And your story, Sir Olmi?" Kenneth Duchamet asked. "Your name and location, please. And remember..."
"The oath assumed," I said.
"My name is Olmi, Apdachitong of Jakarta by birth." "And how did you come to Moonrise?"
"I walked. I've been studying in the Silva."
"Sir Thomas indicates in his report that you claim to have been in the Silva for 2 years. Is that correct?"
"Yes."
"Under what grant or institution?"
"On my own."
"And how were you qualified for such research?" asked Fei Chinmoy.
I looked puzzled. I certainly did not want to answer unnecessary questions.
"Your education?"
"I don't see how that's important," I said. The woman leaned back, glanced at her colleagues, then leaned forward again.
You must have gone to an institution after Link schooling.
No, I said. I'm an independent. I walked on loose ground. How had Divaricate society changed since Link brought them here? Were independents, those who chose to avoid formal schooling, still tolerated?
Did you witness the attack? Fei Qinmoy asked.
No.
Did you hear it while it happened?
I was several kilometers from the river. Larissa stood again, a length of hair falling into her eyes.
He couldn't have been in the Silva for more than a few hours. I saw a sampler bite him, and he called it a forest.
Dushamet looked up at the ceiling in exasperation. We must focus on the village and incidents surrounding the attack, he said. They questioned me for another hour. Thomas listened carefully to my answers, no doubt weighing them against what I had already told him.
I don't feel as if we've gotten the whole truth here, Fei Qinmoy said after the end of the testimony. However, there is no evidence linking anyone other than boatloads of renegades who may or may not be Bryanists, and the only immediate witness to that effect is Ser Larissa Strikashimu, and perhaps this Kimon Georgios, if he can be found. I understand that Ser Olmi took part in the skirmish with the Bryanist flatboats and helped to save most of the children from the boat that sank. We express our gratitude to you, Ser Olmi. You are free to go, but we request you stay in Calcutta and make yourself available for further testimony until we release you of that obligation. We have to report to Athanai and Jakarta by radio. We are damnably spread out on this planet as a bureaucracy, she sniffed.
Larissa had fixed her gaze on me for some minutes now.
I think, Dushamet said, that we're going to have to become much more efficient soon. This is the 9th such raid on Elizabeth's land, and by far the worst, although the first in our district. The north coast towns have been taking the brunt. They are more accessible than towns and villages along the Terra Nova. Sulamit Fei Qinmoy concluded,
For the first time, we have a number of prisoners to use in negotiations. I don't know what good they'll do us, but if Brian's General Bayes is in desperate need of children, how much more desperate will he be for trained soldiers?
Who will protest to the Bryanists? Thomas asked. The citizens' rank glanced at each other. Then Dushamet said, I'll report to the district administrator through the mayor's radio. We'll ship the prisoners to Athanai tomorrow.
Thomas followed me to the bottom of the steps and the main street landing from the river to West Calcutta. I saw tall poles in the direction of the river, rising between a gap in a row of shops. Yards and rigging crossed the poles. Masts, I realized. Sailing ships in the main harbor. A fair number of them, judging by the number of masts. That was where I would meet Randall. For some reason not clear to me, a kind of instinct, I did not want to explain all this to Thomas.
Where to now, Ser Olmi? He asked.
I'm supposed to stay here, I said. That was my impression. Thomas closed one eye and smoothed his crown's shortcut stubble with a thick, strong hand.
But what will you do here?
When I'm free, continue with my studies.
You will wait?
Thomas seemed doubtful.
You won't just vanish back into the Silva?
I don't seem to satisfy you, Sir Thomas. Not that you're alone. My poor mother had higher hopes for me. Thomas acknowledged the shadow wit with a nod and a small smile.
My mother wanted me to be a farmer. I preferred keeping an eye on people, making sure they were all right.
Well, I haven't done much of that recently.
In truth, Ser Olmi, you've shown more courage than I have.
Thomas straightened and clasped his hands in front of him, stretched his arms and shrugged his shoulders.
Cause no harm, eh, Ser Olmi?
That's what I ask of you while you're here. I smiled and held out my hand. Perhaps because of his suspicions, I liked Thomas. He reminded me of instructors I had had in defense school. He took my hand and shook it firmly.
No harm, I said.
Thomas stared after me as I walked away.
When I had gone half a dozen meters, he said, voice raised only slightly, You are not what you say you are, Ser Olmi.
I don't know what your purpose is, but I hope to. I wanted to see more of Calcutta before I met up again with Randall. I doubted that I would get lost in bright daylight.
I strode down the stone-paved streets, walking north between shops and the blank fronts of houses painted white and light gray and yellow, smelling the dust and pervasive odor of Lisbu like dry, dusty ginger. I walked beside a long, straight road, flanked by freestanding houses, well-maintained frame structures whose porches and decks had been allowed to weather to a natural wheaten color, the black edges and stoma marks of Lisbu exterior layers inlaid in simple floral patterns. No street signs were evident, and no maps. Calcutta was not built for strangers. I ate lunch in a small dark restaurant at the end of the main north-south street. The cook and waiter, a thin young woman who kept her gaze on the brightness of the single small window, described the menu to me. Three kinds of grain bread they had baked that morning, Liz cherries and hook vine paste, both from epidendrids, forms Aclenophora and Ampelopsis, and fried flockweed patties. I ordered patties and bread and a single Liz cherry. She looked at my ticket for a long moment, frowned, and walked off to get my food. The bread was chewy, like sponge, but tasted good. The Liz cherry was extremely tart with the characteristic bitter undertaste of all phytid fruit. Some phytids created nutritional packets for mobile scions on long journeys, and these were generally what passed as fruit in Elizabeth's zone. Liz cherries were one of the most common. They were not highly nutritious, but contained usable sugars, some vitamins, and few allergens or toxins. After eating, I stopped by a small park overlooking the river and sat on a stone bench. I took out Nequano's slate and returned to a history of the years just after the crossing. Among some who came with Link to Lamarckia, the history continued, a substantial conspiracy arose. Where it began and how large it was when it began is not known, but it is assumed it began in Thistledown, and there were eventually several hundred of the conspirators who joined Link's secret expedition. They regarded Lamarckia as an opportunity all their own. They would follow Link, they would pretend fealty, but they had their own plans and goals. Upon arriving in Lamarckia, the conspiracy had no strength. Its parts and individuals could not agree on specific goals. Lamarckia, they thought, would be theirs, but which of the splinters would grow the new tree, none could decide. What was decided almost from the beginning, apparently, was Link's unsuitability to rule. Yet within a few years of the crossing, most of the splinters gave up their grand plans, discouraged by the extreme difficulty of maintaining conspiracies within a grander and much divided conspiracy. The last of the splinters, and the most persistent, was the most hidden and thoroughly disguised. For there soon arose a faction that had no Naderite leanings whatsoever. Technophilic, aristocratic, the urbanists followed a persuasive woman named Hezabiah Hoagland, who quickly professed Geshel teachings. Hoagland believed in the necessity of female control of technology. Only through knowledge can women rise above patriarchy, she proclaimed. Naderites, and particularly Lynx divaricates, have tried to return us to patriarchal servitude, to keep us constantly pregnant in order to populate a new world with babies in the most primitive conditions imaginable, quite against the teachings of their supposed mentor, the good man Nader, who was, of course, a man. Hoagland took 77 followers, 20 men and 57 women, and crossed the Darwin Sea to Shea. There, on a rugged coastline, they found a relatively sheltered harbor, and began a settlement in conditions far cruder and more primitive than those at Jakarta or the newly founded Calcutta. Initially, the settlement was called Godwin. At Godwin, conditions improved very quickly, and population grew at a rate double that of the settlements on Elizabeth's land. Some have said that the Godwinians took charge of secretly smuggled advanced medical equipment, or the resources for making such equipment, allowing ex utero births. Soon, the hopes of many of the discouraged turned to Godwin, a golden land across the sea, where conditions, so it was said, were ideal, where no one starved, and where technological harmony with the zones of Shea had been achieved without predation upon scions. Here, it was claimed, vast tracts of land left open by the Ikoi, unused, were ceded to human farming, and, seeded with fast-growing grains. By this time, grain lands had been cleared in Tasman, and Abel Lenk had moved his government to the newly founded port of Athenai to oversee food production. But the attractions of Shea and Godwin were immense. 405 women and 93 men shipped across the Darwin, causing crises in Calcutta and Jakarta. The remaining splinter groups finally united behind a strong and able leader born on Lamarckia named Emil Bryan. A quondam ecologist with some training in agriculture, Bryan, early in life, showed a remarkable talent to convince and organize. This attracted the attention of Lenk's assistants, who could not, however, recruit him to Abel Lenk's cause. Some say pressure was applied that Bryan deeply resented. At age 20, Lamarckian years, Bryan traveled in secret, some say in female disguise, to Godwin. I looked up from the slate and watched part of a triad family walk through the park, two fathers with their respective wives, three girls and two boys in late infancy, and two adolescents, one boy and one girl. Most adults dressed in dull clothes with bright sashes or scarves, and most children in happy tatters of play clothes. I felt a wave of homesickness for the parks of Thistledown, and wondered if I would ever serve as father in a triad, or have any children at all. One of the fathers, the younger of the two, limped. He walked on one leg with a hip swing motion that showed it was a centimeter shorter. He had been injured, and the injury had been imperfectly repaired. The family passed, self-absorbed. The man with the limp had survived his injury and adapted to it. Perhaps they simply took these last few peaceful years as relaxation between challenges, a time to walk in parks and raise children. Life was made of challenges and distortions. What Bryan and his acolytes found in the secret and largely closed society of Godwin was chaos. By fiat of Hoagland, more females than males had been born. Hoagland believed that a society consisting of 9 women to every man would be ideal. She wrote that women who lived together in harmony could do quite well with many fewer men. Oddly, most of the men in Godwin did not object. After 5 years of comparative peace, the plan went awry when several hundred young women, led by a young engineer named Kaitla Chung, formed their own political group, calling themselves the True Sisters. The True Sisters disapproved of what they referred to as the matriarchy, claiming it reduced all women to workers, giving them no say in the character of the children they raised, not to mention no way to exercise natural urges and desires. A kind of religious rebellion occurred, instigated by the True Sisters, none of them older than 18, perhaps with Bryan's help. Hoagland committed suicide, though some claim she was murdered. Both men and women dismantled, some say destroyed, the advanced machines, and perhaps also the miniature factories that could be used to make more machines. The fields went unharvested, and starvation became widespread in the land of alleged plenty. I rubbed the bridge of my nose and eyes, then went to a stone fountain and dipped water to drink. The water I drank tasted sweet and pure. Even if there was contamination from human sewage, it wouldn't matter. All remaining human disease had been eradicated on the Thistledown during the first years of the journey, long before my birth. Mutation of microorganisms into potential disease-causing forms had been eliminated by supplements implanted in all children, even divaricate children, during infancy. The good man had never disapproved of immunization, and these supplements were, so orthodox Naderites ruled, merely elaborate forms of immunization. What mutation of bacteria and viruses that occurred in such a small population as inhabited Lamarckia would easily be handled by these supplements and by natural defenses. The reservoirs of disease were simply not there. Whether Lamarckia's living things could produce disease or could be infected by human pathogens was still an open question, but most experts thought it unlikely. The human pathogens of Lamarckia were cultural and philosophical, not biological. I searched the slate, trying to find updates of the last 10 years, but there was nothing more about Bryan and Shea. Apparently, Bryan had renamed Godwin, calling it Naderville. My ignorance felt like a deadly itch I could not scratch fast enough. I walked to a bare stretch of dirt surrounding a half-dead elm tree, digging my fingers through the tough, hard-packed soil, peering at the grains in my palm. I found bits of fiber, grains of black sand, a dry, dark powder, but none of the living vibrancy of the dirt in the silva. Clearly, this was human ground. The sky grayed again in the afternoon, and a gentle rain fell. The showers stopped and the clouds passed, blowing slowly eastward. I walked along the waterfront, past long, covered docks and warehouses, stone and concrete steps. I shouldered my rucksack and walked beside the brick and stone wall through which steps broke every 50 meters to lead down to the water. In a small building near the main warehouses, adolescent boys and girls in ill-fitting black uniforms stood in rows, listening to a large man with beefy arms and fists like gnarled tree roots explain river boat handling and sailing skills. 7 small boats and a 10-meter single-masted yacht were moored near the building alongside short floating piers. I stopped to listen for a moment, until the large man noticed my presence, then moved on. A riverside market was just closing for the day. A few men with a wagon traded the last of their terrestrial produce to a vendor cleaning out a stall. I saw river catch in the buckets and on tables covered with mostly melted ice, small silvery, smelty piscuits from Zone 5, river celery, purple tubes as thick as my arm, piles of apple-sized shining balls the color of unbaked bread called, reasonably enough, lump fruit. From my reading, I knew that these came from dashers, scions that crossed large tracts of Liz for purposes unknown, but which supplied themselves with lump fruit along the way. Where the lump fruit originated, or whether the dashers actually made them, was not known. Coming into the margin of the main harbor, separated from the Terra Nova by a curving wall, I saw the 2 Bryanist flatboats tied up. Tractors and other equipment were being offloaded on ramps with small cranes. Farther along, the largest ship in port was a full-rigged vessel about 40 meters long, with 3 masts and 2 cylindrical slatted windmills for generating power. 2 gangplanks linked the ship with the pier, and men carried boxes along the planks, loading them onto the ship. More sailing ships, 3-masted schooners, barks, a small ketch, all with elegant sharp prows, all wide in the beam, lay at anchor. One of these ships, a bark with a single, low, large canvas windmill mounted astern, glowed along its rigging and rails with hundreds of little electric lights, and, as if that might not be enough, additional gas lanterns hissed port and starboard. As I watched from the dockside, a sailor walked along the deck, extinguishing the lanterns. She walked aft, reached into a box, and the electric lights went out. I smiled in anticipation. Here, at last, was something I thought I might be competent to handle. I had sailed many times in the 4th Chamber waterways on Thistledown, and had studied sailing ships extensively for this mission, clued by the informer's description of travel and commerce. I knew the nautical terms. What I did not know was which terms the immigrants had retained in the decades since the informant had made his gate and left, and what they had added. Naquano's slate had little to say about ships or travel on Lamarckia's oceans and waterways. I walked a few dozen meters along the pier to the next vessel, a full-rigged ship. A tall, lank, discouraged-looking man stood by a pile of Lisboa plank boxes wrapped in nets, waiting for a short, thick crane to lift the assemblage and convey it into the ship's hold. I approached. "I'd like to find Erwin Randall's ship. I mean, Captain Kaiser Bach's ship." The man looked me over woefully. "I'm the Chandler's assistant," he said. "This is the Vigilant." "Kaiser Bach," I persisted. "He's the captain, yes." "Where's Sir Randall?" The discouraged-looking man curled his lip. "I'm not from the ship, man. I deal with supplies." "Who would I talk to?" "I don't want to judge, but by your dress, you've not had work in some time." He chuckled and shook his head. "She's an eccentric ship, the Vigilant. There's a shortage of seamen here, but you don't look the grade." The man sucked in his cheeks.
I don't spread tales besides, but Captain Kaiser Bach is not the man I'd sail under. A thinking man's thinking man, and what kind of a sailor would that make him? All wrapped in charts and studies.
He tapped his head meaningfully. I thanked him and waited for someone to disembark the Vigilant. Within a few minutes, a man of middle years in long brown breeches and a light coat, chest bare between two half-tight strings, picked his way along the plank with grace. I said, "I'm looking for Sir Randall."
"Not a passenger ship," the man said, regarding me curiously. "I don't know you."
He waited for a moment, then began to move off again before adding,
"Not that I know everybody here."
"Sir Randall told me to report to Captain Kaiser Bach." The man turned and spent more time looking me over.
"Name's French. Navigation and meteorology. Randall isn't back yet. Here's what you do. You go to the researcher's mate. He's in that little shed with the black Lizzie fringe. He's seen Randall recently, and he might know something. But beware. He's arguing with the chief chandler, and he's in a whiny mood, right?"
I crossed the yard to the shed and entered. Inside, bare dim bulbs cast a waxy yellow glow over a dusty desk. Two men argued across the desk, one sitting behind it on a battered stool, the other, a chunky blonde, standing, leaning on the desk with thick arms. It was Shatro. He looked surprised to see me. The man behind the desk looked up, fixed me with sharp blue eyes, and said,
"Ship? Needs?"
His narrow face and thin cheeks gave him a skeletal appearance.
"Randall told me to report to the ship," I said to Shatro. "I'm Chandler here," the seated man said, a broad if not convincing smile displaying fine teeth under his long pale nose. "Do you know?"
"I know this man," Shatro said.
"Why did he tell you to come here?"
I did not really want to explain myself to Shatro and did not understand why he asked the question.
"He did, and I'm here. Where is Sir Randall?"
"He hasn't reported in
yet," Shatro said. He gestured for me to go away, but I stood my ground, and he turned back to the chandler with a look of one more weight laid upon his shoulders. The argument between the two continued. The chandler's prices had gone up twice in the past year, against Lenk's economic suggestions, Shatro claimed. The chandler calmly responded that with 7 ships lost in that year and metal at a premium, it stood to reason gear would cost, and especially gear useful for research.
"Good quality jars and steel receptacles are at a special premium," the chandler said.
Shatro faced me in exasperation.
"We're putting foam on the beard tomorrow morning, and this man cares nothing for science."
But the argument seemed to have lost its momentum. Shatro sighed and stood back from the desk.
"I can't believe Sir Randall told you any such thing," he said to me in a pointed undertone. "Our crew is select. We need Lenk schooling and strong secondary training. Seamanship desirable. Forgive me, but you don't look it."
"I have many skills, technical training and experience, and I'm strong." The chandler looked between us with some amusement.
"Everybody's strong now," he said with a low hoot of humor. "Just a few years ago now."
"Been under sail?"
Shatro asked. I nodded.
"You certainly don't look it," the chandler said, shaking his head sadly.
"He wants you to be a ship's hand, right?" Shatro asked. "We're short of hands, but not that short."
"Excuse me, Sir Costa," he said to the man behind the desk. "Charge what your conscience suggests. You can serve all knowledge, bring honor to your children, and share the adventure, or you can prosper on our hunger."
The chandler received this with a broad smile and squint.
"I trust the next ship you serve on, if there is a next ship, you'll be back with a better argument."
He swiveled on the stool to look more closely at me.
"I suggest you find yourself a less ambitious vessel."
Shatro walked heavily from the shed, across the stone paving. I followed, and behind, the chandler began to crow with laughter.
"You must have misunderstood Sir Randall," Shatro said. "He's master of the Vigilant, but the captain chooses the crew. We've been in Calcutta 6 months, waiting for funding from Athenai, and trying to put together a scientific team. How can you help us?"
I crab-gated, almost skipped beside him, yet spoke firmly, to appear at once youthfully obsequious and competent, assured. Shatro, I judged, lacked the basic elements of self-confidence. Somehow or other, I posed a threat to him. I know physics and the principles of meteorology. I know the basics of ships and the sea, and I'm a quick learner. Shatro stopped, held up his hands with palms toward me, and said, Let me add to the Chandler's poor description of our itinerary. Sir Randall explained, I doubt he gave you the whole itinerary. It's going to be a difficult voyage, to say the least. We'll go east along the summer coast, then swing south-southeast around Mount Pascal, drop into Jakarta to pick up some more real researchers, then south to Wallace Station for another load of researchers. Along the way, we might study the pins in the Chefla lava waste, then sail out to Martha's Island. A journey of 8,000 nautical miles, 14,800 kilometers to you. After Martha's Island, we'll head south to Cape Magellan, make landfall there and study Zone 6, then round the Cape and run west with the Kangxi Current, if it exists, around the unknown side of Lamarckia. We hope to reach Basilica and Nihon, if they exist, and touch Shia from the eastern side. Then we slip through the Cook Straits, an additional 12,000 nautical miles, and still we won't be home. We'll cross the Darwin Sea at the lowest longitudes to La Perouse Land. Only then will we turn north for Athenai, if our ship lasts so long. So, would-be sailor, how many days do we have left before we miss the spring northers and the southeasters from the walking sticks? I don't know, I said. Right, he said. Suspicions confirmed. He turned and boarded the ship. Sir Randall will be here any moment. It's really up to the captain and to him. I took a deep breath and spent the next 20 minutes sitting on a bench at the head of the pier where Vigilant was moored, watching men and women come and go. A small electric tractor pulled a wagon of foodstuffs in casks and boxes to the side of the ship. There it was left to be loaded aboard later. Randall came down to the docks with several other men. He saw me sitting on the bench, gave me a curt nod, and continued about his business, walking along the pier, examining Vigilant, exchanging remarks with his companions, pointing, nodding heads. I had seen men everywhere do this, a ritual of checking and measuring and reassuring, liberally punctuated with outstretched arms and fingers. When the men departed, still talking and pointing, Randall stood by the Vigilant's gangplank and waved for me to join him. "Still no luggage, eh, Sir Olmi?" he asked as I approached. "Thomas will think you're a man without roots." "I am," I said. "Sorry to keep you waiting. Have you been here long?" "Not long," I said. "I had a talk with Sir Shatro." "Oh? I don't think he approves of me." Randall grinned. "The captain makes the choices," he said. "That's what Sir Shatro told me." "Shall we get on with it?" Randall asked. We crossed the gangplank and went aboard the ship. A small, knobby man with darting eyes, quick stringy fingers, and a high forehead topped by thick red hair, Captain Kaiser Bach, gave me a look of pinched concern. The mate and Shatro bustled in and out of his cabin, bringing forms on paper for signing, a printed newspaper, I had never seen one before, a box of manuals and texts, also on paper, and in the midst of this, his right hand wielding a pen and his left pushing signed forms into a folder held open by one aide, the captain said, "I assume the respectable master has given you some idea of what we're facing." "Yes, sir." "Captain," Randall said. "Captain." I examined the cabin, walls of white-painted cathedral tree with Lisboa trim, xyla floor with brass cleats, ceramic gutters beneath a small lap table, a wall covered by rolled charts, and a case filled with large, thick books. A single slate hung in a sleeve from the bulkhead beside the captain's narrow bed. The air smelled of ethanol and other chemicals, arrayed on a table beside an optical microscope. The microscope occupied the focus of the room like an icon. I did not doubt such instruments were far rarer than slates, and that Randall and the captain had fought for permission to take one on the voyage.
Slices of small unidentified scion were laid out on a board, pinned and labeled. But for their clothes, long shirts tied up with belts, loose pants and sandals, we might have been in a late 19th century Earth laboratory.
"No one in Athenai is enthusiastic about this expedition. Some profess interest, some give encouragement, none show enthusiasm. Link himself wonders about its utility."
The captain finished signing and took up the newspaper.
"Some of us, at least, have rediscovered ambition. What's your ambition?"
I said, "To learn about the Ikoi and our place among them, Captain."
"If the Master says you're adequate, I won't contradict him. We'll sail short 3 hands, short 10 if we count seasoned sailors and ABs, but by fate and logos, we'll sail."
He plucked a sheet from the folder and waved it for Randall's benefit.
"Received this while you were up the Terra Nova. Permission from the Administrator of Science and Metallurgy at Athenai. Should have been here 3 months ago. We are forbidden to risk the metal-containing ship Vigilant unnecessarily or to report findings to anyone other than the officers and ministers of Able Link." Science and metallurgy, indeed. As if the ship's metal is more important than crew or mission. The captain thrust the permission form into the folder again.
He shook the newspaper, turned the headline toward Randall, who bent to read it.
"Villages raided on the north coast and around Jakarta, and upriver here at moonrise. Ships taken. Crews let off in boats or rafts."
He drew up his cheeks, squeezing his eyes to slits, and sucked on his teeth, then straightened and lifted one hand as if, after all, this meant very little.
"I've a hunger for knowledge," I said. "I need passage for experience. I need to reach Athenai eventually, that's all. My mother and father told me to go where I can be educated. Apprenticed."
"How old are you?" the captain asked. He had an odd habit of touching the prominent knob of his chin with his fingers and tugging until he had a space of 1 or 2 centimeters between his teeth, all the time keeping his jaw muscles clenched as if in defiance.
20, I said. "Family?"
"Dachetang, a branch not reassigned."
"Prescribed, with no education, then?" the captain asked.
I appeared distressed, nodded.
"Bonded or linked?"
"No triad connections," I said.
"I've been in the Silva for a couple of years on my own, trying to study." "Then at least you have some survival skills. Shall I check with the disciplinary and make sure you're not fleeing his wrath?"
"We both met the disciplinary," Randall said quietly. The captain leaned closer, eyes penetrating.
"You know nothing about our expedition?"
"More now than I did a few days ago," I admitted.
2 years in the Silva, Elizabeth Zone, breath of Logos. You're the mystery man, aren't you? From Moonrise?"
He swung around on his seat to face Randall.
"You didn't tell me that, Erwin. I didn't want to prejudice you. We traveled back together." "I should have guessed. And the disciplinary gives him a fair mark?"
"So far," Randall said. Kaiser Bach pulled his chin vigorously, glancing between Randall and me.
"They say the Bryanists, and General Bays in particular, are working several sea routes, commandeering ships. I don't believe them. I think the Bryanists are blamed over much. But we can't afford not to be
vigilant," I said. Randall seemed to enjoy such cheek. The captain seemed less amused.
"This expedition has been in the making for 10 years, and it starts without the enthusiastic support of anybody in power. We set out with faith and strong drive and not much more." He puffed out his cheeks. "You'd be shocked at the youth around here, and the courage of our seagoing breed. But if the Master thinks you're fit, we'll sign you on as an apprentice. Don't expect to do a lot of science. Expect calluses and shouting."
I made my way around the boat before the assembling of the crew and made my own assessment. In their decades on Lamarckia, the immigrants who had taken to these seas had pushed the words for things nautical this way and that, deleted or elided, added and compressed, but still most were recognizable. Recognizable as well was the design of the Vigilant. A 40-meter, 3-masted, full-rigged ship made largely of Xyla, with brass and steel trim. A few details would have startled sailors on Earth, or in the fourth chamber of Thistledown, where a replica clipper ship had once plied the Lake of Winds. Broad in the beam, forecastle prominent, the bow sharp but with a bulbous protrusion at the waterline. Seen from above, the overall outline of the ship would have resembled a short chisel with a drop of paint hanging from the angled tip. Two canvas-veined wind screws rose abaft and slanted outboard of the sails, their rotors connected to generators within the hull. What I knew of the crossing showed that Link had handicapped his flock deliberately, choosing the most dedicated radical Naderites, who would, of course, eschew the fine technologies of the contemporary Hexamon. Certain instruments and technologies not available in the 20th century, the batteries within the slates, for example, had been accepted by fiat among the Devaricates. But with the significant exceptions noted in the history on the Quano slate, the immigrants had come to Lamarckia remarkably innocent of such skills as engineering, mathematics, and physics, beyond the most basic sort. Perhaps nautical engineering had not yet recovered from Link's choices. In strong winds, with a high forecastle and elevated poop deck, the Vigilant would tend to roll. The wind screws seemed pasted on, and sailing downwind or with the wind fine on the starboard or port quarter could steal from the courses. The dearness of iron showed. The Vigilant was Xyla-hulled and solid enough, but with very few iron or steel parts. Aluminum, bronze and brass, tin and copper were used sparingly. Sails and masts were suspended from and supported by a mix of rope and wire stays and braces. Shrouds alternated rope and wire, and all ratlines were rope or lisbu. Where wire was used and where rope seemed to vary with whim, the main backstay being rope, forestay wire. And yet the backstay took the strain of the following wind. I felt a sudden shadow of worry. I hoped I was wrong, but for the Vigilant I judged there would be trouble at sea, continuous, nagging trouble, which could explain the loss of so many ships. As for the crew, 31 men to 12 women, the youngest apprentices delivered by their triad families to a sea trial, failures perhaps at Link school, despite the captain's speech to me. The eldest, largely able-bodied seamen, or ABs, hired from the rejects of the none-too-large merchant fleets. Even with 20,000 inhabitants, commerce was slow, sea travel haphazard, and hazardous besides. I saw more clearly why the captain had taken me on with so little resistance.